Okay, could you just start by saying your name?
Yeah, I'm John Bell, and I'm Regius Professor of Medicine in Oxford.
Okay, so start, can you just tell me a little bit about yourself? If you can get it into about three sentences, how you got from your earliest interest in science and medical issues to where you are now.
Yeah, so I'm a clinician scientist. I've been in Oxford for more than 30 years. I came here originally as a Rhodes Scholar, trained in medicine here, went to London, came back, worked with David Weatherall, and then spent most of the 1980s in Stanford at the height of the molecular biology revolution, and then came back here in 1988, ran a program in immunology and genetics, became Nuffield Chair of Medicine following David Weatherall in 92, and then 10 years later became Regius Professor of Medicine and sort of broadly responsible for a number of the strategic things that have happened in Oxford Medicine over the past 20 years.
And if there was one big question that gets you out of bed in the morning, what would you say it was?
Yeah, all my professional career, I've been extremely interested in getting a much more precise understanding of the mechanisms of different diseases. It's these days people call it precision medicine, but the ability to move from clinical patterns of disease to a real understanding of what's going on at a molecular level is that's the thing that's kept my research going and kept me interested in the field.
So we could talk for ages about your interest in the genetics of common diseases like diabetes and arthritis and so on, but I think the strategic side, which you mentioned, is really what we want to focus on. You've been involved in those strategic questions both within Oxford and beyond. So let's just start with Oxford for the time being. How would you describe the state of research in medical sciences when you, either when you first got here in 87 or when you first became Nuffield Professor?
Well, I experienced it a bit when I was a student here because I came as a Rhodes Scholar and did the honor school course in physiological sciences and then went to the clinical school. And it was very, very small scale. There were some extremely able people in the medical school. And of course it had a distinguished record even though it was small, but it had limited horizons. It didn't really feel like it had huge scope and it was going to tick along as it had done for 500 years and that was all fine. And it was really over my time as a medical school that it began to step up to say, no, we can do more than this. Biomedical science is likely to be the big scientific operation for the next 30 years, so let's make a move. But the university then was pretty complacent about where it sat in the global world of academic excellence. I mean, I think it thought because it was Oxford, it was the best university in the world, and it clearly wasn't. By some margin, clearly wasn't. And there was a view, I think, that we could be good at everything when in fact we probably couldn't, and we certainly couldn't compete. And of course, in the sort of 1970s, the funding for science was pretty limited nationally. So it was really hard to compete at any different level. So, you know, I had that glimpse of Oxford as a declining organization over that period. A great place to be, loved to be here as a student, it was all fabulous, but really, you know, it had I think, a view of itself which was unrealistic. By the time I came back from Stanford in the late 80s, things had started to move in the medical school, largely driven by Peter Morris and David Weatherall to build it up. There was a very strong global health program long before anybody else. David had built the Wellcome Trust, built the Weatherall Institute, now called the Weatherall Institute, which was a real successful venture in molecular medicine, which is the reason I came back. And then when I took the chair of medicine in 92, I could pick up on where he left off and started to build this campus, which is the old Road campus, where we've now got 8 or 10 institutes, you know, 2,500, 3,000 people. It's one of the biggest biomedical research campuses in Europe. And to build excellence in a whole variety of domains where the university had never really played. Cancer, for example, where we built an excellent program, we'd expanded the genetics of common disease, we'd really built on our strengths in immunology and infection, We built out the data themes that and data analytics, Big Data Institute, and drug discovery has become a central part of it. So that, I mean, this has been a huge expansion over 20 years.
And how was that funded? I mean,
all kinds of different ways. I think, you know, the funding of these things require quite a bit of kind of entrepreneurial flair, because there isn't any single pot of money that you can get all the money from. So you get a bit of money from here and a bit of money from there. And I think the crucial bit of the vision, which the total vision was never pitched to anybody, but the individual component parts of the puzzle were pitched one at a time as being exciting, what we need to do now, this is the next step in building global excellence. And those then get pitched, they get a donor, you build a building, you recruit people, you expand it, and so on and so forth. So that's basically how the campus has evolved. And that, you know, I spent most of my last 20 years building out this campus and building the excellence that's kind of underpinned it. So that's been hugely interesting and exciting.
Mm. And if that hadn't happened, we probably wouldn't have had a vaccine program.
No, probably
or,
not.
Or Peter Horby's stuff.
No. A lot of that wouldn't have happened. So I think the underpinning of the excellence in Oxford Biomedicine has really come from the dramatic expansion in people and infrastructure that's occurred over the past 30 years, probably, you know, in broad terms. And that's been hugely impactful.
So before we get back to COVID in Oxford, I'd also like to address your role in national bodies. So I've just got down a couple of things here. So from 2006, you were both the third president of the Academy of Medical Sciences and the first chair of something called the Office for Strategic Coordination of Health Research. Yeah. So what were your goals in those positions?
So it actually goes back a bit before that, because one of the things I picked up when I was in Stanford was the huge opportunities that came with the growth of life sciences and biotechnology. So by...
This means in the commercial sector.
In the commercial sector, yeah. So by the time I became Regius Professor, which was 2002, I'd been involved in the creation of a couple of biotech companies. We built one of them up. Another one ultimately fell over. But I was very actively engaged in that space. And in 2002, on the back of that experience, I was approached by Roche, which is the big Swiss pharmaceutical company, who asked me to join their main board in Switzerland. So I joined their board in 2002. And I that was a huge opportunity for me, one that I didn't even know when I signed up how big the opportunity was going to be, because understanding how a large life sciences company actually works at board level is a fascinating experience. So first of all, you understand big companies, which is an issue in its own right, but also how do you generate innovation inside the context of a large entity? And that is really hard to do. And Roche went from, in the time, I've spent 20 years on their board, and in the time that I was there, we went from having almost no products in late stage development to having a profile of products which was better than almost anybody in the industry, and that was by driving the R&D agenda. So I had a lot to do with that when I was at Roche. I was very heavily involved. I spent a year on sabbatical in Basel working with the team at Roche. So that was a dimension to my experience which most people in academia don't have, and I think that really created opportunities for me in the last 20 years to do stuff that most academics never get a chance to do. And one of the things that emerged from that was that when the presidency of the Academy came up, they called me up and said, look, you should do this. And I thought, well, you know, not really, I've got other things to do. And anyway, with a bit of arm twisting, I decided to do it. And that turned out to be a really good thing to do, because the Academy was just about to take off.
We so it's got, quite new. You were only the third.
I was only the third. Yeah, Peter Lockman was the first. Keith Peters was the second, and I was the third. And at that stage, we had no permanent home. So, you know, over my time there, we took the facility in Portland Place, took a 40-year lease on that, raised the money to redevelop it. It was the old SIBA building for SIBA Symposia. So we got it on a firm footing, but we also pushed really hard to get it recognized by policymakers in Whitehall as the place to go. If you want advice on medicine, don't go to the Royal Society, go to the Academy. And so I spent a lot of time working with people like David Willetts and the likes who were there at the time. And indeed, over that period of time, I also worked with Gordon Brown and Tony Blair and all that team. And that they, when they got to the point that they would come to us for advice. David Cooksey, of course, was very active over that period, trying to, again, from his commercial background, trying to build up life sciences in the UK. And he,
so what was his role?
He was an advisor to government. He was an ex-venture capitalist. He set up Advent in the UK. Very impressive character. And he was very close to Treasury because he chaired a variety of the big Treasury committees. And he was incredibly supportive of the idea that we tried to make the life sciences agenda, publicly funded agenda, much more coherent. So he wanted that all brought together under a single board, which was the Office for Strategic Coordination Health Research, which managed the flow of money to MRC, to the new National Institute of Health Research, which is Sally Davis's show, and anything else that the government wanted to fund it in that space. So I was asked to be the first chair of that. Gordon Brown was the chancellor. They upped the amount of money for life sciences and the MRC and the NIHR by a very substantial amount after about a year that we had Oscar in place. And that was the beginning, I think, of a really good run for life sciences. Because, of course, we were still also skating on welcome funding, which was growing year on year. So it was a really good time to be doing biomedicine in the UK. And it was dramatically better than any other scientific subject who didn't have the ear of government and didn't have the support that we have from the big charities for biomedicine. So that, all that was good. So I, of course, when I'd been doing that for a while, people said, well, look, talk to JB. He knows lots about industry. He knows lots about biotech. He knows lots about academia. He's the person to go to if you want information about how we make this all work. Because the governments, successive governments, were very interested in the economic growth agenda because they finally realized that we couldn't keep digging coal out of the ground and making steel. We had to do stuff which is in the tech sector. So I was brought in, I think originally in the Gordon Brown era, which was, as you know, short-lived, and then by David Cameron, and I was nominated the life sciences champion for the UK. And that basically, that meant the guy you talk to if you want to talk about building up life sciences. And
but that didn't involve you in having a big secretariat behind you.
No, I mean, my secretariat, which I used pretty effectively initially, was the Oscar group. And we had four or five people. We were based in Treasury. And I was very, I think this, there's a good story here because the, it turns out that, it turns out that one of the most effective ways of getting things done in Whitehall is to be friends with the people in Treasury because they've got all the money. So it's good if you know the Prime Minister, very good if you know the Prime Minister, but almost as important to know the Treasury guys. So the Office for Strategic Coordination, this is Cooksey's idea, was in Treasury. So I had an office in Treasury. I knew all the officials in Treasury. We would meet all the time. And so I developed a whole set of personal connections that other departments couldn't get at. Because, of course, the other departments were desperate to talk to the guys in Treasury. But I had an office in Treasury. So, it's interesting how these things just happen to occur. So I had this great network. And then when David Cameron came to power, he was extremely interested in building up life sciences, and he wanted me and a chap from AstraZeneca called Chris Brinsmead to help advise him as to how we could use the strength of the health system in the NHS to help build a commercial entity. And the point I made to him, which I think he accepted, is that it's very hard to imagine how a country could spend 30% of its public sector spending on something like the health service and not expect to get any economic growth out of that. Because at the moment, you know, at that stage, there was no relationship between the NHS and the commercial sector. So I promised to help build that in a systematic way over a period of time. And we did David was fantastic because he was very interested, and he was a very affable sort of prime minister. He was very keen. If you went to see him, he always wanted to write things down. And so I went to see him with Chris, and we would give a report card on how people were performing. We said, this is what they should do. And then we would go and say, well, that was definitely beta minus, and that was alpha, and all the rest. And he paid a lot of attention. And of course, David had this personal issue with one of his children who had a terrible developmental disorder and had really been very tough for him. So, you know, on one occasion he said, look, you know, you know a lot about genetics. Can you come and talk to me about genetics? And of course, I knew even more than most people about genetics because Roche is the world's biggest in vitro diagnostics company. And it was at that stage they were looking at what a company like that could do in the whole world of clinical genetics. So they had explored all the companies that do genetics and had discovered that actually the price of DNA sequencing was about to fall off a cliff and become very cheap. So I went in one day, and with a couple of others, Mark Walport and Sally Davis and others, we gave David Cameron a tutorial on modern day genomics, which he loved. And he said, oh God, he said, this is terrific. We really need to do something in this space. So I pitched the idea of the 100,000 Genomes Project to him, the Genomics England Project, which he loved. And he said, right, well, I'm just going to do that. So off we go. And
how was that project set up?
Well, it was set up by the Prime Minister. It wasn't set up by peer review or by the MRC. It was just set up by the Prime Minister.
He said, and how's it funded?
Funded straight from the Department of Health.
Right.
Yeah. So it was another example, and I've been involved in three or four of these over the years, that if you want to do really big and ambitious projects that are high risk, don't go through the conventional funding system, because you'll never get there, because they shoot at you until you drop dead. So we did that with UK Biobank. We did that with Genomics England. We're doing it now with our Future Health. So,
but the object with Genomics England is to produce eventually a commercial product.
The object was to see whether you could turn genetics in a healthcare system into something which was much more ambitious, capable of delivering a much better result for patients, and ultimately generating genetic data which industry and other people and academics could get great benefit out of. So that
and
there
which
were lots.
Industry would have to pay for.
Which industry? My view at the time was that we wouldn't necessarily want industry to pay for it. We would want them to be interested in coming to the UK to do their work that would actually allow them to get to X, Y, and Z. It wasn't a transactional thing, I'll pay you this and we'll get you that. What it was, look, we've got this great resource, why don't you come see if it's helpful in drug discovery or diagnostics and see where we get to. So that was the ambition of that. So so David was really good because it shows you how powerful it is to have the Prime Minister on board, because when it stalled, which it did, he would pick up the phone and say, what the heck's going on? Get going. And as a result, it took about 18 months to get it going after he decided to do it. But then, you know, they were off to the races. And it all turned out to be true because the price of sequencing fell by a factor of about 3 or 4. And it became affordable, and they set up Genomics England, which ran with that. And I've been on the board of that since. And it's, you know, it's been quite a successful enterprise. And it was way out there before anybody else had ever thought of it. So at a national level, that was, you know, those sort of things actually have had quite a big impact on the UK's position in the global biomedical space. So UK Biobank, which I was also involved in setting up, which is run by Rory Collins, as you know, Genomics England, these are the kind of things, they're big projects, they use the NHS capacity to do things at scale. They're the sort of things that academics all over the world want to see, be able to use effectively. And industry is obviously extremely interested as well. So that in my role as life sciences champion, I did a lot of those things. Then, of course, we had the Brexit debate. David stepped down. Theresa May took on the job. She reappointed me as life sciences champion. I worked with her and Greg Clark because they decided that...
He was the science minister.
Right? No, he was the Bayes, Secretary of State for Bayes. Yeah. So science was underneath him.
Yes,
but he
yes.
was the... But he wanted us to do industrial strategy, not in the classic Harold Wilson sense of the word, but in terms of, are there tech sectors that we need to build up? Are there areas of high-value jobs, high-value growth opportunities that we want to build up. And the first one that he chose was life sciences, and it was me he asked to lead it, again, because I was known pretty well in Whitehall. So we wrote a report, which we published, and then we have been busy rolling that out up to 2019, brought in about £3.5 billion of inward investment, invested about $600 million of UK government capital, but it created a huge opportunity for the life sciences. And the industry, I think, widely views the UK now as being one of the best places in the world to come do research and build a industry from. So that kind of gets us to 2019. But by the time 2019 came, everybody knew me because I was the advisor on life sciences. I knew all the ministers. I knew the secretaries of state. I had a team of people called the Office of Life Sciences, which I worked with closely, who were responsible for building up life sciences between Bayes and the Department of Health. And, you know, I was a regular visitor with Jeremy Haywood, obviously in number 10, but also with Jeremy Hunt, and David Pryor was then in health, James O'Shaughnessy. So anyway, all the ministers knew me, and that was sort of where I got to. And Oxford, although obviously in my role in Whitehall, I couldn't preferentially support Oxford. Anything we did for life sciences nationally, Oxford's boat was going to float as fast as anybody's. And, you know, that has driven a lot of really exciting things in the Oxford environment. Digital pathology, a lot of stuff around sequencing of UK Biobank, all that stuff has fed back to here, and that's all come out of the life sciences strategy. So it's been quite a symbiotic relationship between building up things here, but also building up things nationally.
That's really, really good background. Excellent. So let's get to COVID itself. So can you remember, I'm asking everybody this, when you first became aware that this was not just a little thing happening in China?
Yeah,
this was going
no,
to be a big
I,
deal.
I can remember. So I think I suspect most people can remember, actually. But I was skiing at Christmas with my family in Switzerland. Because when I was at Roche, I bought a chalet in the mountains in Switzerland. So I was standing on the deck at Christmas, must have been late afternoon, and I got a phone call from Jeremy Farrer, who was director of the Wellcome Trust, but used to run our unit in Vietnam, and I was a close friend of Jeremy's, a very good guy. And he called me up and he said, I don't know whether you're paying attention, JD, but there's big trouble in China. And, you know, in Wuhan, there's an outbreak of a pretty severe respiratory illness. It looks a bit like SARS, but it could be something else. They're busy sequencing it. We're trying to work out what's going on, but this, I suspect, will be the next pandemic. So, that was a bit of a doodah. And so I thought, okay, well, this is pretty good. And then, of course, the head of China CDC is a guy named George Gao, who was a postdoc in my lab for 5 years. So I know George very well. So anyway, I got in touch with George. I can't remember if I phoned him or how I got on. Anyway, the truth is that George, of course, was up to his eyeballs in this thing, and he said, oh, no, this is bad. This is definitely bad. We'll have the sequence by the beginning of January, I hope, and we'll be able to tell you what it was. So that was when I knew there was likely to be trouble brewing. The sequence, of course, appeared about the 7th or 8th of January, and it turned out to be a SARS-like virus. And so you knew that there would be potential trouble. Now, the previous two SARS-CoV-1 epidemics had burned themselves out relatively quickly, high mortality, 35% mortality, but they'd burned themselves out. So there was a view that it'll all be okay because it'll burn itself out. Nobody knew why the previous ones had burned themselves out, which is a bad place to be. But anyway, the downside scenario was it wasn't going to burn itself out, it was going to move around pretty quickly. So I then, of course, I kept doing what I was doing, but I was pretty attuned to what was happening in China. I went to a board meeting at Roche late January, and I still remember we started the board meeting with a chairman session with the board and the chief executive, and I said, what are you guys doing about the pandemic in China? And they all went, what pandemic in China? And I said, well, let me tell you, mate, you guys are a global company. You got a big problem. And by the way, you're going to be called upon because you have all the diagnostics, you've got all the therapeutics, and you better sort yourselves out. So anyway, no one in the room had really clocked it at that stage. And it was very striking because we had the head of Nestle was in the room and the head of Shell was in the room. And, you know, these are really top-end people. And no one had clung. And I thought, oh, Jesus, this is not good. These guys are not paying attention. This is a really serious. And by this stage, they were shutting down large bits of China. Lots of big cities on the East Coast were being shut down. It was, I mean, it was starting to get to real crisis proportions. So that was a sentinel moment for me because I thought, actually, not only are we going to have a pandemic, but we're going to be caught completely unprepared. So I came back, first of all, they said, okay, thanks for that. We better get moving, which they did to their credit. Not fast enough as it happened, but anyway, they did get moving. But when I came back here, I started poking the NHS to say, you guys ready for this? And I got a whole barrage of rather complacent responses saying, it'll all be fine. I said, well, how do you know it'll all be fine? Well, it'll all be fine. These things, they burn themselves out over the Indian Ocean. They don't really go very far. Don't worry, we got some guy working on preparedness in the NHS. I can't remember his name, but you know, he's doing something. You know, it was one of those. This is a road crash waiting to happen. So that, now, about the time I went to that Roche meeting, I also went to a meeting which was summoned by Richard Cornell, which you will have heard about, which was the first assembly of everybody. Yes. And there were about 35 or 40 people in the room. And
this
it was in...
Just to fill in for people who are listening, this was kind of all the top medical researchers in Oxford coming together to say, this is a crisis we need.
Yeah,
to
that's right. And all the ones who felt they could contribute something. Yeah. So everybody was there. Alan Townsend was there. Sarah was there. Adrian was there. Andy Pollard was there. Everybody was there. It was really good. Dave Stewart was there because, of course, he's a spectacular viral structural biologist. Gavin Screeton is a viral immunologist. We had an amazing array of people. And I looked around the room and I thought, boy, this is a really impressive show. And, you know, at that stage, there were lots of statements. Sarah was really confident she would have a vaccine because she'd been working on MERS. Alan had another strategy for Belgian vaccine, which was a perfectly good one. There were lots of interest in what the virology was likely to look at. There were good relationships with Porton Down. So we were talking about how we did stuff in that space. Dave Stewart was already created the structural proteins of spike so that he could study them using crystallography, did some of the early studies with the Chinese, as it happens. So, and then there was this massive global network, and Peter Horby, of course, was linked into the global network. And he was saying, we got to get this right, because in the flu pandemic in 2010, we completely screwed up clinical trials. It was a complete mess. So that I went away from that meeting thinking, boy, that's really impressive. And I'd be really surprised if anybody can compete with that. So on one hand, we had total complacency in Whitehall and with the NHS. And yet in Oxford, there was massive activation with people who didn't have any money, but were doing their best. The university was great about allowing us to spread our money a bit wider to get on with some of this stuff. And then in February, the first cases started to appear in the UK. There was the couple in York who were Chinese visitors.
And then, Brighton, I think.
And then just after half term, which was just about now in February, it was the second or third week of February, everybody came back from half term and they brought COVID with them. So they had the Brighton outbreak. They had a number of other isolated cases. It was clear that the disease was on shore. And it was also pretty clear from the Lombardy experience in Italy, which had started about a month before, that this thing was going to go. The Lombardy curves were terrifying. And our curve was right on the left of the Lombardy, but it followed exactly the same trajectory. So I remember sharing thoughts with Jeremy where we looked at the data with it. Right, this is going to look just like Italy. The thing's going to crash. And of course, in Italy, all the healthcare systems had fallen over. There were people in the aisles and lots of people dying. Nobody really knew how to look after the disease. So that was there was obviously a national catastrophe going to come. And at the very beginning of March, I got summoned to a meeting. And I can't remember who summoned me to this meeting, but I think it was Will Warr, who is the health SPAD in number 10, who's an old student of mine. Actually, he's an existing student of mine, still a student of mine, I haven't finished his bloody DPhil, but anyway, He's a very good guy. And he had worked with us in OLS and then had moved across with Boris when Boris came into that job. And it was doing a great job, I have to say. And he said, look, we've got to get a grip of the testing. So there were about 8 or 10 of us in the room. And we'd also had a meeting with the industry guys, who were not very good, actually, because the industry guys were all promoting their own products, and it was all a bit hopeless. So Jeremy and I and Will, and then a couple of guys from Public Health England, Alex Sinkovich, and one of the deputy CMOs, and anyway, there was a mixture of people. And I brought in, because I was the government advisor on life sciences, so, you know, they said, well, what do we do next? And I said, well, you know, the obvious approach to diagnostic testing is PCR, so we should get some PCR. How many PCR tests did we do yesterday? And anyway, they said, well, in the whole of the NHS and the whole of Public Health England, we did about 4,000 PCR tests. I said, you got to be joking. And they said, yeah, we've run out of supplies, we don't have any nucleotides, because of course the whole of the NHS was built on a sort of it's what they call a homebrew model, and that is you make up the test, you buy the supplies, you get three nice ladies on level 7 to do 4 tests a day, and then that's, you're done, everybody goes home. Well, that, I can tell you that was not going to work in a pandemic, and there had been no planning to fix this. The original PCR test developed by Public Health England was the wrong test, so it wasn't very helpful. The WHO was clumsy and slow. They got the wrong primers. The whole thing was a complete dog's breakfast. So I said, look, you're going to have to get tests from the commercial sector, because that's, you know, you can't do this on a homemade job. You've got to do this at scale. So I then got a call from somebody in the White House saying, no, it's okay, we've done a deal with Roche to provide us with the stuff. And I had nothing to do with that deal, because of course at that stage I was just stepping off the board at that stage. So I said, look, I can't have anything to do this. But you need to know Roche cannot produce very many tests because they're not used to doing that. So if you're lucky, you'll get about 5,000 tests a day from Roche, which basically doubles the number of tests you got, which is miles below what you're gonna net. So I said, you've chosen the wrong supplier. And then over the course of the next week, I had a nice call from Claire Wallace at Thermo Fisher, who's another big American diagnostics company. And of course, I knew all these people from my life sciences job. So Claire called me up. She said, JB, I can't get anybody to answer the bloody phone in Whitehall. And I said, well, what do you want to talk to them about? She said, well, we can provide you with tests. And I said, how many can you provide? She said, well, we can do 100,000 a day if you want us to. We've got lots of supplies, we've got a really good test, but I can't get anybody to answer the phone. So I then went in through my contacts at Office of Life Sciences, and I said to the lady who ran Office, I said, you're gonna have to take this on because no one else is competent to do it. So we had another quick meeting, Jeremy, Will, Krista McLeod, somebody from Public Health England, and I said, look, you will not get this done through the NHS. They haven't got a clue. So you've got to set up labs which only test, big, huge labs, automation, robots, blah, blah, blah. And they said, well, why not have a distributed model? And I said, well, because you won't be able to manage it, because you'll have machines breaking down, the quality control will always be different, you won't know what to have it. Have 3 big labs, 1 through 3. So they said, okay, what are you going to do? And so I knew about the bioresource in Milton Keynes because it was a grant to Oxford that had funded the bioresource in Milton Keynes. And I also knew that they had a staff of about 30 people and they were underemployed. So I called up the guy who ran that and the chairman of their board, and I said, you guys have to become a site for doing large scale PCR testing.
Was this after, because I remember when I spoke to Derek, he talked about how you called him up and said, we need somebody to validate all these.
That was the next step. It was the PCR thing, which was the first thing.
Yes.
And then I also knew the guy who ran there was a center in Manchester in Alderley Park that again was called this Medicines Discovery Catapult. And Chris Malloy ran that. He was an old friend of mine. So I called him up and said, Chris, we need a site in the Midlands or in the Northwest. Can you set this up? So he said, JB, I'm up for it. Let's go. And then I said, well, let's let the Scots fight amongst themselves as to whether it's going to be in Glasgow or Edinburgh. So I said, just somebody tell the Scots to sort it out, but they need one up there as well. So we created, literally in a week, three major centres. Thermo said, we know everybody who owns one of our machines nationally. So we sent the army out to pick the machines up from the universities, took them all to these sites. They set it all up. They've got the hardware, and we're literally day to day, because the numbers of tests had started at about 4,000, had fallen back in the NHS to 3,500 because they couldn't scale it. And so now we started to try and build the story to get to 100,000 tests a day, which was the target that Matt Hancock set. Probably not a smart idea, because he had no idea whether we'd get to 100,000. He made the number up. Anyway, he asked me, called me up, said, you know, can we do that? And I said, you'd be bloody lucky, but we could try. So anyway, and that was by the end of April. So we had the tail end of March and the whole of April to get to that number. And in fact, in the end, we did get to that number. But that was, so that was step number one. And then I got James Bethel, who was the secretary, was the junior minister for life sciences, Lord Bethel, who I got to know pretty well, called me in and said, look, I think what we need is we need a vaccine passport. So we need serological testing so that people can prove themselves if they've had the infection, it's all fine. So I said, well, that's a hard pitch. So I called Derek and said, look, Derek, I need some help on this because you know how to do this. And he said, okay.
So this is antibody testing.
This is antibody testing.
Right, yes.
And this, it all fell flat because the tests were no good. But it also fell flat because we realized we didn't know whether the antibodies actually protected you from another infection. So actually that had about a month where we were trying to build it all up. Meanwhile, in Oxford, Dave Stewart and Richard Cornell and the team had built this really terrific lab-based antibody testing thing, which was hugely accurate. In fact, we showed it was the most accurate of all the platforms that were available and was a really terrific asset for monitoring the surveillance of who'd been infected globally, and nationally. So all that stuff, the antibody thing was going around like this. PCR was on its way. I got two calls a week about PCR, and I just said, keep going. You know, Kristen called me up. That data thing was hard because the NHS can't do data. But anyway, there were various blips. They set up these big, you know, drive-up testing sites that still exist, and, you know, they built out the three lighthouse labs. So testing was looking pretty good. The lateral flow tests for antibodies didn't work. The ELISA, the lab-based ELISA, did incredibly well. And then, they had four pillars for testing. The first was PCR testing. So I'd been very involved in that at the beginning, stepped back once it got going. The second pillar was antibody testing, which was either lateral flow antibody testing or ELISA programs. The third pillar was surveillance. Maybe that was the fourth pillar. Anyway, there were four pillars. Mm-hmm. And so the surveillance thing was a crucial thing because we had to get some read about what was going on. So one of my close contacts in Treasury was a guy named Mike Webb, who was the economic advisor to the Chancellor. And Mike called me up and said, look, you got to keep us briefed as to what's going on. So I was having a conversation with Treasury with some regular intervals, and I said, surveillance, Mike, we've got to understand what the hell's going on here because we have no idea. And for God's sake, don't trust the NHS, because the NHS has been given a huge amount of money to run their own little ELISA programs to work out how many people were infected. So they did it. And then there was radio silence because they couldn't hook the data up. So they couldn't assemble all the data. So nobody knew after all that, they couldn't know that. So I said, just forget all that. We need to set up studies. So Mike said, you should call the Office of National Statistics. I said, great idea. So I called Ian Diamond. I was working very closely with a woman called Tamsin Berry, who is still working about doing a lot of stuff with me. And she's one of the best civil servants I've worked with. She was really outstanding. And she had been given responsibility for helping with the surveillance and the antibody testing. And I said to Tamsin, look, you know, Ian's up for this, so why don't we get going? So it was on the back of that we got together with Ian. He said, let's make a plan. We need to find a PI. I said, well, the person for that is Sarah Walker. She's terrific. And so, you know, obviously she is terrific. And And she ran with that. And that's, again, been a flagship of the whole program, led by her and supported by ONS, and just massively impressive by every standard. So that's how ONS got started. That was Tamsin, really, but I made the original contact. And Jeremy was very involved in that as well. That's why you see our names linked with the thing as it goes on. And so that was all fine. And then in the background, of course, the famous vaccine was rumbling along. So Gavin Street called me up. He said, look, JB, I'm worried about the vaccine because, first of all, I have no idea whether the bloody thing's going to work or not. But if it did, we're going to be in massive trouble because, of course, there's just a million things that we can't do as a university. And I said, yeah, tell me about it. I mean, it's just, they're so far gone on terms of scaling this thing up that I said, I don't think they really know what they don't know. And there's a complexity because both Sarah and Adrian are big shareholders in Vaccitech. And Vaccitech has it's got an angle on the IP, even though they've done nothing to contribute to the making of the vaccine. That was all Sarah. They've got an angle on the IP. That is going to be complicated, and we can't go blindly into that. And thirdly, we've got to make sure the bloody thing is safe before it goes anywhere. And at this stage, there was an outcry from some Oxford academics saying, oh my God, because there's this concept of enhancement where you give a vaccine and the disease you get is worse. So they said, oh, there's going to be enhancement. But we also all agreed that we needed a partner. And they're
a commercial partner.
A commercial partner. Yeah. So all the things that we don't do, global regulation, you know, it's now approved in 170 countries. How are we going to do that? We've got 20 manufacturing sites all over the world. We've produced and deployed 2.8 billion doses of the bloody thing. How are we going to do that? So this is where it got quite complicated because, of course, there were people in Oxford saying, well, we can do that. That'd be a bloody joke. You know, that's just, you know, it was crazy. Yeah, and even Vaccitech said, well, why don't you use us? Well, you know, Vaccitech was, you know, a tiny little biotech. I mean, had no experience on any of this stuff. And I'd had a conversation with Roger Perlmutter, who was the head of R&D at Merck, who, again, I knew, he's a great friend. And he called me up in January to say, what do you know about the Oxford vaccine? And I said, I think it's pretty interesting. I said, it's not a vaccine yet, but it could be a vaccine. And so he said, well, tell me if you're interested in pursuing it. And I think Adrian at that stage said, no, we don't want to pursue it with anybody. But then at this stage, I said, look, we better call Roger up and see what he's going to do. Oh, 10 minutes. Yeah, I've got it. We're running out of time.
Okay.
Rapidly. So Roger called me up and I said, look, Roger, I think we should have this conversation. He said, are you sure Adrian and Sarah want to talk to me? And I said, well, I think so. So I spoke to Adrian and Sarah, and they said, yeah, let's have the conversation. So they sent the BD team over it was all on Zoom, but we talked to the BD team. We drafted out what it would look like. I said, you guys would be a great partner. There are a couple of problems, though, and one is it's going to be really important we make this stuff on shore. And they said, well, we make it in Ireland. I said, no, that's not gonna work. We make it in the US. I don't think God said it's not going to work. So we went back and forth, all very friendly, I have to say. There was no hostility. And then Sarah and Aiden got cold feet and said, no, because Roger's, he's a tough guy. And he said, no. He said, if we take this on, we take it on. But just to be clear, we're driving the bus. You're not driving the bus. So they got very twitched about that.
And had the issue of at cost for developing countries come.
Yeah, so there were two red lines. One was at cost for the world, actually, and the second one was global production. So that Merck were pretty comfortable with global production because they can do that and they've done it before, so that wasn't a problem. And they're, you know, they're one of the big vaccine players, so they know what they're doing. And they, we never got to the end of the conversation of at cost. And I think where we were going was at cost for developing countries, but not at cost for the US. They were going to make money in the US. And I think the vice chancellor and Gavin and I had all thought that the, given the scale of what was going to be a huge global healthcare crisis, it was going to be hard for us to be making money off the back of that, and that we would prefer that it was at cost everywhere. And I was talking quite a lot to Trevor Mundell, because I chair the Gates Global Health Committees, and Trevor is the president of Global Health at Gates, and they know vaccines inside out. So I said, Trevor, help. We need help with our vaccine because we can't do it ourselves. And he said, boy, oh boy, do you need help? So he put a lot of his team on thinking about what we would do. And it was at that time that I think Richard Gerling, who is at Centerview, who's a great friend of Oxford, had contacted Adrian or Sarah and said, you should talk to Pascal at AstraZeneca, which they did. And I remember because they went to see, they had it, well, I'm not sure they went to see him, they probably did it all on Zoom. They may have gone to see him, I can't remember. But they had a long conversation with Manny and Pascal, and Pascal had decided that he was going to do this. Well, Pascal had been the head of pharma at Roche when I was on the board, so I knew him really well. So he called me up and he said, JB, I need to talk to you. So I said, okay, let's off we go. What are we going to do? So I remember a long conversation on a Saturday afternoon with Pascal, went several hours talking about what we'd do, what they thought about the vaccine, what they thought the prospects were, could they do it, could they not do it. And we got to the two big issues, not-for-profit and global manufacturing. And he said, no, we're up for that. That's what we will do. We do need to make money out of this thing over time, but certainly for the first period of time, for the first year or whatever, while it's a crisis, we will do our best to get you at a cost-based vaccine. So I then called Trevor and I said, Trevor, can they do it? Because I said, we can't do this deal if you don't think they say. So I'll talk to Emilio, who's their top vaccine guy. So Trevor called me back. He said, yeah. He said it'll be a push, but he thinks they can probably do it. They're really good at biologics. It's a great company. They should be okay. And most importantly, they're philosophically aligned with you, so you're not going to have a fight with them starting on day one. So so we then talked to the principals, the scientists, and they all said, looks okay to us. And I said, okay, off we go. So we then got the university legal team in play. AstraZeneca legal team got a term sheet out within 4 or 5 days. No discussion, no arguments, no trouble. It was all fine. Settled on a royalty rate, which was pretty acceptable for us. Milestones, they were very generous about milestones. There was no problem about the commercials. And the principals were all in there, so that was all good. And then so during the course of all this, of course, I had continual input from Whitehall, saying you need to keep us involved because it's really important to us. So I was talking to Maddie McTernan, who was the senior civil servant now on the vaccine task force, and Matt Hancock and James Bethel. And we were working our way through the story bit by bit. And Matt Hancock said, you can't do a deal with Merck because they won't be able to do it onshore. So that's a no-no, you just can't do it. So I realized that the Merck line was dead. And I called Roger and said, look, we can't do it, Roger. And he said, look, it's fine. He said, don't worry, there's no hard feelings. Off you go, and good luck to you. He said, it's going to be hard, but good. So that was sort of how we got to the signing of the deal, the plan for the future. AstraZeneca were going to run a big trial in America. They rapidly extended their manufacturing footprint to 20 different sites all over the world. They got organized with seed stocks, got people organized to start to make product, which incidentally was much more complicated than they thought or we thought. Turned out to be a delay. Because remember, this was by now, we signed the deal in April, I think. By June, they were busy trying to manufacture. We didn't really get large-scale manufacturing going till the end of December, did we? So, you know, it was quite a hard piece of work. So anyway, that sort of gets you to the end of phase one.
Yeah, we probably better stop there because we've got less than 5 minutes to go. Yeah. But I've got 2 pages of questions still to ask.
Well, you better come back and see me.
Can I come back?
Come back for another hour. Yeah, good, because I can.